And we're back! Welcome to another episode of Mike, Mike, and Oscar doing the Oscar Sprint Profile Dance once again.
I raise my handkerchief to my brow and dab it. You can all applaud me now.
In support of what was being said here. We're doing the Darkest Hour today. We're doing the Gary Oldman vehicle, the best actor win that he's had coming on about 20 months now since this project was announced.
We're talking about Churchills and Chamberlains and Halifaxes.
Yeah, and negotiating with Hitler, which always is a good idea, I think. And apparently so did, what's his name in this movie?
Halifax. Stephen Delane, yes. Stannis Baratheon himself. That's how he will be known.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
You should watch more Game of Thrones.
The only man on earth that doesn't watch Game of Thrones.
How is that possible?
I don't know. I'm just...
On my programming, we're like going to do a whole month on Game of Thrones.
Just fail my parents as a failure. I like to fail those around me as well. But yeah, we're doing Darkest Hour, the Gary Oldman special. He's already won the Golden Globe for the best actor. He's won the Critics' Choice for the best actor. He's getting a little backlash, getting a little competition. Timothy Timothy Chalamet is bouncing at his heels. Chalamet is on his heels for Call Me By Your Name. But
did you shave or are you Gary Oldman right now?
I
need to know this.
When I shave, I always try to like trim my beard and then I end up just taking it all off on one side. And then I'm like, well, now I have to do something. So that's what happened here.
That's what happened.
Also, I'm Gary Oldman.
Looks good.
So
it looks good. I mean, seriously, bro.
It looks good on you, though.
You look how I feel. No, I'm kidding. It looks good.
So let's try to get this started. Any thoughts about Darkest Hour before we get into all the big stuff here?
I like Joe Wright movies. Amazingly so. I'm not Atonement, yes. The Soloist, Hannah. Anna Karenina, I like those movies. I didn't like The Pan. I didn't like The Pride and Prejudice. Here's something about me, and this is very telling and very embarrassing. I have tried three times and failed miserably to either watch or read Pride and Prejudice.
Aren't you a writer? Isn't that what, like, that's supposed
to
be on the tentpoles?
It's supposed to be, and I've failed miserably. This year, I tried to read it. I got like 40% through. And then just went like, ugh, too much of a jock. And then I tried to watch the Keira Knightley version. Nope. Tried to watch the Colin Firth version. Nope.
So you got to get Audible. Audible's got to sponsor us, and they got to hit you up with
I'm going to try the audiobook next. It's literally on my library audiobook apps that you can get
it's
the audiobooks
been sitting
for free
there for years,
for decades,
mocking you. Yeah.
And I got to do it. I got to do it. That's like the one major gap in my whole. Literary research.
Yeah, that's the one.
That's the
we
one.
We found
right
it.
There. How about you? Any initial thoughts on this one?
No, I'm surprised about the. I'm surprised he's still getting as much love as he is for this performance. I can kind of see why, but at the same time, it's. You know, we're not talking about Daniel Day-Lewis and Lincoln here.
Right.
It's a great job. I think it's a good performance. We'll obviously get into it, but is this a performance that you're gonna, you know, is gonna mark his career? We'll see.
It has sprung a lot of Gary Oldman GIFs on Twitter, or GIFs, or GIFs, or Jifes.
Yeah, I think the I is silent.
I think the Jife, hard I, hard I. Lot that we've, you know, incorporated in,
yes, in our day-to-day.
My tweets. I shouldn't drag you down into
this.
You've
been doing very well with the tweeting, by the
way. I'm trying. I've sent a couple out a day. I'm having fun with it.
Let's do the social media recap now. If you want to reach out to us through this unnecessarily long intro and yell at us for wasting too much of your day, which we totally understand, Mike, Mike, and Oscar on Facebook, Mike, Mike, and Oscar on Instagram, MMO_pod on Twitter, Mike, Mike, and Oscar @gmail.com. As always, we love hearing from you guys. Cannot thank you enough. We've kind of stepped up our listenership, which we truly are grateful for, and we hope you guys keep telling your friends, and we hope we're putting out a quality product for you.
Yeah, we're really appreciative. Thank you, thank you, thank you. So
now back to Mike being a failure at social media.
Yes. I don't know what Instagram is yet, but I'm making like, I'm like a 60-year-old person, like a grandparent or something, where I like did Facebook for a while on this. Now I'm moving to Twitter. Eventually I'll get to Instagram.
Stop yelling at me over text for texting too much. So that's a step in the right direction.
Mike wants to argue with me in text message format because somehow, I don't know how you do it, you plug your text messages into your computer.
When you're a slave to Apple,
QWERTY.
You get everything. Yeah.
You got QWERTY and I got one finger at a time. I'm one finger Joe, and it's like the most ridiculous argument ever. And he gets out like four paragraphs before I can type in one sentence.
I think QWERTY versus One Finger Joe is the first match in Punch Out.
It's the opposite of the way we podcast, because usually I just ramble on and he can't find a way in. Poor guy. So it's total revenge time for you.
But and listen, we are closing in on 6 minutes.
6 minutes of ribble rabble.
Just nonsense.
We're doing this, I think, subconsciously, because we're avoiding what we have to talk about, and that's Gary Oldman domestic violence charges, not charges, but allegations. And that's, you know, I mean, look, this is six articles worth online. This, I haven't done a deep dive on this.
And this exists. I mean, he got a lot of flack for it after his Globe and Critics' Choice wins. The people are coming out of the woodwork on social media saying, you know, why is people like Harvey Weinstein being persecuted and Gary Oldman, who has a history of similar allegations, getting away with this stuff?
The article in the Daily Beast, Gary Oldman, the Oscar frontrunner with a dark past. And there's another article in The Sun, and it's .UK. That was back on January 10th. Those are the two main articles I use for this. But basically, Oldman was accused of domestic violence back in 2001. He has vehemently denied it. He was not prosecuted. In fact, he was awarded full custody of his two boys shortly after the incident.
Yeah, it's an interesting addendum to the story. Obviously, we weren't there. Or, like with any of these allegations, we never know the truth. None of us are there. All we can do is what we keep saying throughout our shows here, is just you got to listen to the people that have been victimized and listen to their stories and support them. And that's kind of the same song and dance here.
Dania Florentino, or Fiorentino, I think it's pronounced, she didn't really get a whole lot of support at the time. However, there were some conflicting allegations. Gary Oldman himself accused her of being a drug addict. And it got really ugly where the courts ruled in his favor, like I said. Now, I mean, you can be a skeptic, and you can, and I don't think it goes as far as skepticism necessarily, but you can basically not have faith in our justice system and think that she got a raw deal there. But he did, in fact, win custody of his two boys after the incident. She has had problems with addiction. He was a recovering alcoholic at the time. The incident essentially was a fight over the telephone where he ends up ripping it out of her hands and hitting her in the face with it. That was the allegation.
Yeah, again, allegedly. This
the,
is all just
the lawyer. The lawyer has said it never happened. It was never prosecuted. It was never even brought up in the case or something like that. So it's a very strange situation where we have less information on it than we would something a couple years ago.
What a fun year in Hollywood to start this podcast, huh?
Right, but he did get blowback on Twitter. A lot of
For sure. Yeah, people were not happy, especially at the Globes.
Right.
Especially at the Globes, so I noticed.
While he was up there and not thanking any women other than his wife, but not like he.
But he also didn't thank his director at the Globes, and yeah, he made fun of that at the Critics' Choice.
Yeah, then on Jimmy Kimmel the other night. But so it was an awkward situation, no doubt about it. I almost forgot. He also got in trouble with a Playboy magazine interview. It was after Mel Gibson was recorded dropping racial slurs and saying awful things to his girlfriend.
Yeah, I want to say 2014 this happened. This was the interview.
Yeah, a lot of nasty language in there, a lot of racist stuff from Mel Gibson. And essentially, I don't want to paraphrase him. He said talked a lot of trash. I think his thesis statement was saying that everybody, you know, talks trash at times. We're all hypocrites. We all do wrong. I think it sounded to me like he might have wanted to say something good, but then again, he uses all the same awful language. So I don't know why you would. I mean, it's just dumb to me. Like even if he meant well, it's just the fact that he had all that stuff in his vocabulary, in his vernacular. He used all the homophobic slurs, all the racial slurs, all the chauvinistic language.
The same interview, which he went on to go say, winning a Golden Globe is meaningless.
Yeah, in an article with Playboy, a freaking objectifying magazine of women everywhere. It's just so tone deaf and so dumb why he would do that. So, I mean, he was an asshole for that article, no matter how you feel about the allegations here. He was an asshole for that article.
Now, the blowback, it taints the performance maybe a little. It certainly taints the industry as all the horrible actions that we've heard about do. But again, we keep saying we're going to be better off for it. It has to be addressed. We have to talk about it. And you know what? If it takes all of us a couple seconds to think about big issues before we talk about movies like we do, I don't see how that's a bad thing. if we have to think about our actions as men, especially as white men, especially, I don't think that's a bad thing.
Super especially. Yes. To jump in his biography now, born in New Cross, London, Gary Oldman was the son of a welder and former sailor. His father left the family after being very abusive to his mother and to his son when Oldman was 7. There's an article in the Sun by Amy Jones, released back on January 10th, where Oldman talks about his abusive dad, his overcoming of alcoholism. His dad was an alcoholic back in the day as well, and Gary Oldman overcame 4 divorces throughout his adult life. So a lot of those problems, if he has them, or however severe they were, or, you know, you can call the derivative back to his childhood with his abusive father.
Thank God the movie's only about Nazism, huh?
Right. Oldman was very musical as a kid. He wanted to be a pianist, but after seeing Malcolm McDowell's performance in The Raging Moon, he decided, quote, I want to do that.
And also, I'm scared of Malcolm McDowell now.
In a SAG interview, Oldman often remarks about his acting card, which this is encouraging for all the wannabes like us, like you out there. And he needed to work 40 hours before he could get a card. And it was like this dilemma where you could not get a card until you worked 40 hours, and you couldn't work without a card.
Yeah,
right?
Like all these jobs say they want experience for entry-level positions.
So he had a gatekeeper, and it really turned off a lot of his friends, and it turned off a lot of his contemporaries. And he eventually found that, okay, you can get a provisional card. So we went to audition after audition, knowing he didn't have a card, and basically just wowed people to the point where they had to hire him, and they gave him a provisional card.
Yeah, he is quite good at the whole acting thing.
Yes, yes. I mean, he's also been nominated in the Overacting Academy Awards several times, but we'll get to that as well. Oldman made a ton of English theater and worked with the likes of Mike Leigh and Peter Howitt, who'd go on to become directors in another life across the pond in Hollywood years later. Oldman was known for a trademark intensity and became a favorite of audiences in the early 80s. One of those audiences was in Glasgow, Scotland. They particularly loved all of the Oldman performances, and he keeps going back there to do, you know, a play here now and then, because those are his biggest fans, I guess.
How about that? My people. I'm home.
His breakout film role came with the part of Sid Vicious in the 1986 film Sid and Nancy.
Yes.
A year later, Oldman starred in Prick Up Your Ears and earned a BAFTA nom. Roger Ebert called him one of the best young English actors. And at that time, in 87, 80, 88 it is. And the next thing Oldman knew, he's going to Hollywood and getting a ton of auditions and smaller film roles. The first of which came alongside Dennis Hopper, Francis McDormand, Alan Bates. Oldman starred opposite Tim Roth in Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead, and then opposite Sean Penn and Ed Harris in State of Grace. Oldman moves to the U.S. full-time, turns down the role of, guess who, Edward Scissorhands for Tim Burton in 1991, I think it was.
That would have been a different movie.
And instead, he takes the job of Lee Harvey Oswald in Oliver Stone's JFK.
And if Johnny Depp played that, that would have been a different movie.
The rest of Oldman's 90s featured Luc Besson's films, Leon the Professional and The Fifth Element. This is where the overacting police kind of take him down. And
yes, a little bit. I mean, that Leon the Professional role, I think, is vintage Gary Oldman to me.
It's nonsense. I don't know. I don't know. I'd have to see it again.
That character made an appearance in Darkest Hour as well.
Yes. Interesting note, Oldman did the now memed line, "Everyone, bring me everyone!
Everyone!"
Yes, I mean, he did this as a joke to make Luc Besson laugh. And maybe this is what he says, you know, after
the fact. Revisionist Hollywood history.
This is what he says after the fact. But he said it during several interviews that it was a joke. He just wanted to be so loud with it and make the director laugh. And that's what Besson used in the final cut. He remembered
totally get the last laugh.
mortified when he saw the film in theaters and laughing his ass off. Now, 1990s, he's partying like an animal. he's going on 70-day drinking binges. So he's really has a problem. By the mid-90s, Demi Moore says to him about his alcoholism, quote, this is in the Sun article, "You're very ill. You have to go away. I'm very worried about you," unquote. And Oldman seemed to finally take it to heart, and he does go to rehab.
Demi Moore, saving lives out there.
Other 1990s films and performances Willis, that I know and like, he played the Reverend in The Scarlet Letter. That was an adaptation I had to see a lot back when I was in like a sophomore in high school. Anyway.
You went to the greatest high school of all time.
No.
I don't think you took tests. Yeah.
The Russian hijacker he plays in Air Force One is
pretty off my plane.
Yeah, it's pretty vintage as well. So, I mean, Oldman does write and direct a movie. There's really his only one until next year, Nil by Mouth, about his childhood where he was abused by his dad. That winds up being nominated for a couple of BAFTAs.
BAFTAs love him, by the way.
Right.
They love Gary Oldman. Rightfully so.
He's set to direct his second film next year called Flying Horse. So it's taking up quite a gap.
What do you think that one's about?
I don't know. Nil by Mouth doesn't make any sense to me either.
Like, he's just putting prosthetic angel wings on actual horses and leaving a camera there as they stomp around in the grass. I need to take a nap.
The Red Bull's kicking in, Mike. Listen, Oldman
earned... Come back from that.
Oldman earned a SAG nod for 2000's The Contender, an Emmy nomination for two guest appearances on Friends, and resurfaced in 2004 after this kind of gap between his big movies as Sirius Black in the Harry Potter film Prisoner of Azkaban.
Yeah, he's black. He's back. Yep.
Great quote.
Thank you.
2005 started his Nolan Batman trilogy as Commissioner Gordon in Batman Begins.
He should be that role for life. I got offended when I saw they replaced him.
He spends kind of the next 7 years mostly doing big budget movies, mostly doing these franchises, Sirius Black and Commissioner Gordon, and five different sequels between the two movies. He talks about why he did that. He was a single dad at the time. He wanted to be localized in Hollywood a bit, but he also wanted to make as much money as possible because kids are like going through college, and it seemed, and he was talking about it like putting food on the table. So,
man, I'm down with dramatic. That, though. Yeah, well, I mean,
but
sure,
so if you're
going to
sell out, you're going to sell out big.
Right, but if you do sell out, if you embrace it, you're like, yeah, I wanted money. That's fine with me. Yeah, why not? Go get your cash.
Listen, we will gladly sell underwear and whatever it takes
sell out. Don't, like, no. If you give us an underwear ad, we're going to say it's for money. We're not going to look at the artistic quality of the writing in the ad.
We'll never wear the underwear ourselves.
Why start now?
Gary Oldman does a lot of big-budget movies, and as the 2000s come to a close, the first decade, he finally gets some juicier roles. He takes on George Smiley in Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, which is it's a much better movie the more you watch it. It's the slowest movie ever. I joked with my little brother. I took my little brother to this movie way back when. And I just joked with him. I was like, this movie's just going to be about British men handing each other dossiers for 2 hours.
And that's exactly what it was.
That's exactly what it turned out to be. We were the youngest people in the theater by like 40 years.
Well, that's how I was with Darkest Hour yesterday.
Yeah. It was quite the crowd. Anyway.
I remember talking to you after you went to see Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. Here's a little side quest since we've already gotten so far off track. Why not? Mike and I went to both giant Super Bowl parades the 2008 Super Bowl and 2012 Super Bowl. We went to the 2008 one. It was great. Went to the 2012 one. We got there later for whatever reason.
Right, naked.
Yes, of course. We could not find a place to stand. Like, we couldn't see the parade from anywhere. The streets were so packed.
Right.
So we ended up going to Little Italy, going with two of Mike's brothers, going to Little Italy, getting a food, meeting DJ AM randomly at the restaurant. And then we went to a movie afterwards just to kill time, all four of us. And I wanted to see Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. And you were like, that's the most boring movie I've ever seen. I remember that. So we ended up seeing, of course, The Woman in Black. The Daniel Radcliffe horror story. Fell asleep in the chair.
Which is exhausting, yes.
And then we went home. And that's how we spent the giant Super Bowl parade.
Yeah, that was kind of an epic fail there. The first one was epic. It was like rock concert, confetti in our faces the whole time. It was the greatest moment of our young lives. It was so unexpected, too.
The next one, we just got lost, got angry. Right.
It was literally all the papers falling down on Winston Churchill's head for 2 hours. It was that moment.
It was an unbelievable time. It
saving the world.
Yeah. What are we talking about?
Gary Oldman in 2015.
Who's that?
Gets a book deal to write novels, and he's writing currently a vampire series called Blood Riders.
It'll be great. Whatever.
Anyway, over the years, he's been intensely private. He's shied away from the spotlight. He's had alcoholism problems in the 90s. He's been to rehab quite a bit, 12-step programs, meetings. He really gets behind those. He's been married 5 times, including his first marriage to Leslie Manville and another marriage to Uma Thurman.
That's crazy. I mean, not only the names, but 5 marriages is insanity.
Leslie Manville's currently starring in Phantom Thread, which we'll talk about probably next week. In 2012,
Who's Uma Thurman?
In 2012, Oldman had some beef with the Hollywood Foreign Press and called their voting, quote, bent and the ceremony as meaningless, quote.
And here's your Golden Globe.
Now here's your 2017 Golden Globe winner for best actor in a motion picture drama. Yes, Oldman was a single dad for 10 years during the 2000s. And like I said, he wanted to make his money while he could there.
Why not? You got to do you. You know, no one's going to feed your kids but you.
Even still, Oldman is known as one of the better chameleons in the acting community, saying that from the very beginning of his career, one of the most fun things he loved to do was dress up and play other people and immerse himself in those disguises. In fact, one of his nicknames he's earned throughout his acting life is Mr. Potato Head. That's my closing remark on Gary Oldman.
Absolutely no joke lined up for that. I was not expecting it. All right, so he's Mr. Potato Head.
The Darkest Hour also stars Kristen Scott Thomas as Clementine Churchill.
As all English movies have to.
Some of the Kristen Scott Thomas's most notable performances are Good Ones, 4 Weddings and a Funeral, Mission Impossible, The Horse Whisperer, Gosford Park, and Nowhere Boy. She was nominated for...
We reviewed Gosford Park on here. That was part of our 2001 Best Director series.
Did we release the 4 Weddings and a Funeral one yet?
I don't think we did 94. Okay. We have 94's Best Picture tape. We just
recorded
it
like...
So we're probably going to have to re-record that at some point.
A year ago. Bad audio, but maybe we'll release that at some point. Kristen Scott Thomas was nominated for a Globe and an Oscar for The English Patient, and another Globe for I've Loved You So Long. Nominated for 5 BAFTAs, she's won a Best Supporting Actress for 4 Weddings. She's been nominated for this year's BAFTA for Best Supporting Actress in this film, The Darkest Hour.
You want to see someone that'll scare the Christ out of you with just her eyes? It's Kristen Scott Thomas in pretty much every role she has.
Yeah, she's a great actress. Something to add to her, I didn't do a whole bio, but she's always said she didn't want to play wives. And she didn't want to play characters that were just wives. And Joe Wright had to convince her of like the overall arc of this character.
Yeah, they did so little.
And she has a nothing part. She does well with it. And it's amazing.
That's part of my biggest gripe with this movie. You got 2 strong female characters.
She does a good job with it. We'll talk about it. Ben Mendelsohn is King George VI, the part played by Colin Firth to Oscar glory back in The King's Speech. Mendelsohn
should have gone to Jesse Eisenberg.
Mendelsohn has been in lots of great stuff, including Animal Kingdom, where he kind of broke out, The Place Beyond the Pines, gambling movie Mississippi Grind alongside Ryan Reynolds, Una from last year.
Besides, said she was married to Gary Oldman once.
Who? Una? What are you talking about?
That's a dad joke. Una, Uma.
Oh, that's terrible. You changed the letter. Look at you. You're hysterical.
Oprah Uma. Oprah Uma.
So Una alongside Rooney Mara. He was the bad guy in Rogue One, A Star Wars Story. Did a good job in that. A couple seasons of Bloodline on Netflix. And he's a busy man over the next 5 years, this Ben Mendelsohn. Starring in 5 movies in 2018, including Ready Player One and Robin Hood. And he's set to star in 2019 opposite Captain Marvel in the Marvel Studios
version. Get that Marvel
version.
Money. Good thing we're remaking Robin Hood again, though, because I think really the 18th time in Hollywood's going to be the charm.
I think they're doing another one with Margot Robbie as Maid Marian. It's just called Marian.
They don't need to do... Can Robin Hood and King Arthur just be hung up and just put on a shelf? King Kong, too, for the most part. Just put these properties on the shelf for a while.
Public domain, man. Free stories. Yeah. Anyway, Lily James plays Churchill's, I guess you call her a secretary, Elizabeth Layton, typist.
Loved her. She was great in this.
She's best known from Downton Abbey and the latest Cinderella. She was also Deborah in this year's Baby Driver, and she's set to star in three movies in 2018, including Mamma Mia, Here We Go Again. Mike, you can start singing now.
I don't get it.
No?
Ronald. Dancing Queen!
Gloria. Didn't they do Gloria? No.
That is ABBA, yes.
Ronald Pickup is never...
We're waxing poetic and making jokes about our own podcast now. We've done enough episodes. Go back and listen to the...
I'm going to change my name to Metal World Peace.
The Itanya episode, if you want to have any clue what that exchange was just about.
Ronald Pickup is Neville Chamberlain, and Stannis Baratheon / Stephen Delane is Viscount Halifax. Some story inception notes. The screenwriter Anthony McCartan wrote the script on spec, which means it was unsolicited or uncommissioned. They didn't pay him up front, in other words. So, yes, he was established for Theory of Everything, and yet he writes this one totally on his own.
So basically every piece that you and I write can be classified as on spec.
Correct.
I'm not that.
I'm writing...
We're not broke. We're just on spec.
We're just on spec. Joe Wright read the script. He laughed a lot to his surprise. He cried some. And
While reading it,
Joe Wright, the director.
That might be a mental problem.
And when he heard Gary Oldman was kind of loosely attached, he said he had to look into it. Oldman was one of his heroes for 15 years, all the way back to Sid and Nancy. And for Wright to take Oldman from Sid Vicious to Winston Churchill as an overall
career arc, yeah,
it was just too tantalizing to resist for Wright. Oldman hasn't auditioned for a role in a while. Big surprise.
Yeah, shocking.
But Joe Wright flew over from
also
Britain.
Also, the people at McDonald's have never asked if I'm sure once I place an order.
This is a Guillermo del Toro-like joke right there, my friend. I like you. Anyway, Joe Wright flies over from Britain to meet Oldman in Hollywood. They hit it off. Essentially, their first meeting was meet at a hotel. They're both kind of nervous because they both like each other's work. And they just go out on the patio and vape for 2 hours, 3 hours.
That's how you make friends.
Best friends.
2017, people.
Oldman wanted to play the role and considered gaining the weight. One of his idols was Robert De Niro and his performance in Raging Bull as an example of how to gain like 40, 50 pounds. But Oldman considered the fact that he's 60 years old and figured he'd have to gain 70 pounds to get the jowls and the neck at the very least, you know, to a point.
I would think.
So he decided to stay at a similar weight and just do the makeup a couple hours a day.
And to the credit of the makeup department, I thought the body type looked pretty remarkable. I mean, you can't see many prosthetics there. There was the word.
Yeah, I wasn't totally distracted by the makeup either. I guess we'll talk about it in a few minutes. Oldman's voice coach is Tim Monarch, and he credits this man
Great English names these are.
Right?
Joe Wright. Tim Monarch.
Oldman credits Monarch as one of his initial steps to every performance in terms of conquering the voice and helping him figure out the dialect. So we shout out to Tim Monarch, I suppose. Directors have always marveled over how Oldman memorizes and internalizes his scripts. He definitely did that for this movie. He essentially had a whole year to prepare for it. He memorized the whole thing. Like I said, directors have had Oldman quote Shakespeare on command during their productions while they're setting things up, just like as a parlor trick.
Yeah, we talked about that in our Lady Bird, how Greta Gerwig was so enraptured with Laurie Metcalf playing the same lines different ways that she would kind of get lost in it and just kind of have her as her little plaything. And I can imagine with Oldman having that trick up his sleeve, he must have been a hit.
Yeah, so, I mean, Oldman on command performing roles from his past, and they say that to this day, other actors. Like, he remembers full speeches. So Oldman did do that.
And
he
he's
memorized
method, too, isn't he?
He's method. He made it this joke 100,000 times during the promotions. He quoted his wife as saying, "I went to bed with Winston Churchill and woke up with Gary Oldman," and everybody laughs. But I don't know what that means. That's like a merry joke. Anyway, Oldman, knowing, and then Oldman says, "Well, it's good that it wasn't the other way around."
Gary,
and everybody
I've been
laughs.
Trying
even
to tell
more.
You that's my way of saying I'm cheating on you.
Listen, Oldman knew he wouldn't be able to read the script in the makeup chair. He essentially had to work with the makeup and costumers. With all the prosthetics going on, he had to be very involved in the process of getting all this stuff on his person. So he really couldn't study while he was doing this, so he memorized it in advance. It's in all the history books. Oldman said Winston Churchill had a great sense of theater in him. Churchill demanded a level of commitment. If the people were not on the same page as him, he was known to tear people a new one.
It's well documented.
But he'd also become like this teddy bear and say, "Oh, I didn't mean to." He took on this guy. Oldman says, "This racist fuck, this tyrant. America was not in the war at the time. Hitler had 5 million soldiers. Britain had 300,000. Our world order that we've enjoyed over the last 70 years arguably comes down to one man. Heaven knows what it would look like had he caved." So England would have become a puppet state, all that going on. Gary Oldman really dove into the history, certainly McCartan as well. Oldman didn't want to watch any of the other performance of Churchill's over the years. He had seen the Hardy performance as a younger man, but he didn't want to watch the Albert Finney, a.k.a. Mr. McGregor Papa. Can't speak. But instead, he wanted to watch all the true historical footage. Oldman watched a lot of newsreels and recorded speeches. That was, quote, paramount. Listen, John Hurt was originally set to play Never Chamberlain. A sad story here. He was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. John Hurt fought a swift losing battle with the disease and died of cancer in January of last year.
Yeah, it sucks.
Joe Wright also flew out, and Joe Wright's just hopping around on a private plane here. He flew out to meet Kristin Scott Thomas because she initially turns the role down. Again, she doesn't want to act in a lot of...
I am amazed that he was able to convince her. Why wouldn't she turn this down? After reading the script, especially.
He goes all the way to Paris to convince her over a cup of tea, and she said that Clementine Churchill has these remarkable ankles during their conversation. And that's when Joe Wright knew he had her, because she was obsessing over this woman's appearance in photographs and the ankles, the curvature of her ankles. That is what actors talk about.
I don't even know what that
means. In researching the relationship between Churchill and his wife,
I don't think I would notice if a human didn't have ankles.
I can't see my ankles right now. Need to go on a diet. Anyway, Kristin Scott Thomas realized it was a fiery relationship between Winston and Clementine. Clementine ran the house and was horrified about the amount of money Winston was spending on his cigars, on his drinking. I'm also horrified, and I'll tell you in the production notes about how much they spend on cigars and the champagne in this movie. Anyway, Churchill had said, "I can easily get used to the best." And apparently the Churchill household went bankrupt for a few times over during the process. That's not a lie in the movie. But even if they were staying in the same house together, and he's a politician, he's a world traveler, they were away apart from each other quite a bit. The Churchills wrote letters to each other every single day of their married lives. Something they continued from Churchill's war service, and he was a prisoner of war back in Africa way back. So those are the pre-production notes. I got some production notes as well here. Not as many. Oldman spent over 200 hours in the makeup chair during production. Yes. Oldman
200
smoked.
Hours.
Now, this sounds like a total bunch of BS to me. I'm just going to say that off the top. Oldman smoked over 400 cigars that equated to $20,000 worth of cigars. Because that would mean it's $50 a cigar.
I mean, it's possible, right?
It's possible.
They exist.
Listen, I mean...
As a prolific cigar smoker.
I've been known to smoke. By the end of this podcast, I'm going to sound like this. No, I mean.
How old are you? 32.
$50 a cigar is absurd. They have them out there, but I can't see that.
That Focus feature money, man.
You see, like, Puff Daddy smoke, or whatever his name is now, but you
he
see him smoking
Puff Daddy
like,
on us.
You see him smoking like $15
cigars.
Name
two Puff Daddy songs.
It's all about the Benjamins.
Yeah, okay, that's one.
And it's all about the Benjamins remix.
Nailed it.
I win. Listen, this is unheard of. But they had over 4 weeks of rehearsal for this movie. So Oldman, all the actors, Mendelsohn, Kristen Scott Thomas, they got to live with each other and live with these parts for a while before this film.
But there's no parts in this film.
You say that like it's a definitive statement. What are you talking about, no parts in this film?
There's one person explain, in this movie.
No, we're going to talk about it. In the middle of production and full makeup and in between takes, get this, Michael, Gary Oldman proposes to his girlfriend and he does it as Winston Churchill. She accepts and then he was called right back on set.
I just think that this woman doesn't like Gary Oldman. I slept with Winston Churchill. I'm married to Winston Churchill.
I'm
married to Winston Churchill.
She's that British. Yeah. Anyway, no, I have no idea who his fiance is at this point. I think they got married since, but that's all the production information I have on this movie, The Darkest Hour. Mike, you have some specs?
Yeah, we're only 3 hours into this. Let's start specs.
We digress.
Let's do some specs for Darkest Hour. Of course, the movie came out in 2011 starring Emil Hirsch. I got an 18 from Metacritic. And about five young people in Moscow who lead the charge against an invading alien race. That's actually a movie called The Darkest Hour.
I've seen it. It's terrible.
So that exists, just for you people out there to know. Darkest Hour, written, like Mike said, by Andy McCart and directed by Joe Wright, He of Atonement, Hannah and Anna Karenina fame. It's 125-minute runtime from Focus Features, so one of the few contenders that A24 didn't have their hands on this year. Debuted September 1st at the Telluride Film Festival and went wide in the UK on January 12th, which we recorded on, and is my birthday, that's correct, on this year of 2018. $30 million budget. It is
I'm
thus
done
far,
saying happy birthday.
It is
done.
Thus,
it
is
enough
thus,
is enough.
It is thus far. Gross, 55.8 million dollars. That would be 36.8 domestically, only 19 million worldwide. But again, the movie just came out a few days ago in its home country of Britain.
It's making decent money, I think, so far.
I mean, you're already talking that it's almost at twice its budget. So yeah, having been in Britain for 4 days now, 5 days, it's doing decent. 7.4 IMDb rating on roughly 13,000 reviews and 85% certified fresh rating on Rotten Tomato on 209 critic reviews, 178 of which are positive. 7.4 out of 10 average critic score and 85% audience score.
We've been seeing a lot of 8.5s or above for a lot of these Oscar movies.
Yeah, this
That's
one's
not
a little lower. This one's a little lower, and the Metacritic rating will say that too. It's a 4.1 average out of 5 for the average user rating on 8,500 reviews. 75 Meta rating from Metacritic, which is, put it in perspective for contenders this year, 1 point lower than The Disaster Artist. You imagine Oldman's going to hear his name in the Oscars up against James Franco.
Right.
Again, unless the Time's Up movement takes one or both of these men out of the picture.
The voting happened
Who knows?
Late for that.
Yeah, it did. I mean, it did. We'll see.
The voting happened early.
We talked about the potential fallout in our Golden Globe.
I don't know.
75 was 11 points lower than Shape of Water. Darkest Hour may hear its name for Best Picture. Shape of Water just won the Critics' Choice for Best Picture. And 8 points lower than The Post. Again, you're going to expect to hear Tom Hanks. Not getting a lot of love from the critics. It wasn't well received. I kept teasing. Every time we brought up Darkest Hour in previous episodes, I kept telling you how the critics weren't crazy about it. I can remember, and I don't have the stats to back this up. I should have taken a screenshot of it. I can remember seeing this in the sixes on IMDb.
Right.
After the filming and the Telluride screening went out. So this has not been something that's been widely accepted as much as other Oscar contenders this year. Give you some awards profile on this movie. As we've been saying, this is the Gary Oldman show. This film has thus far gotten one Golden Globe win, lead actor for Gary Oldman. It has four Critics' Choice nominations. It did take home two wins, nominated for Best Score, Best Picture. It won Best Makeup. Mike and I just commented on the makeup. We will further in a minute. It also won lead actor for Oldman. One SAG nomination, also for Oldman. You're not going to believe this, but the movie that's all about the fearlessness of Britain and its people by the leadership of the most famous leader in Britain's history has a shitload of BAFTA nominations. 9 nominations in total for Best Production Design, Best Costume Design, Best Cinematography, Best Outstanding British Film of the Year, which I refuse to believe is an actual thing. Best Supporting Actress for Kristen Scott Thomas, Best Makeup Hair, Best Original Music, Best Film, and of course, Best Lead Actor for Gary Oldman. It would seem as though Oldman has been the lead dog in the pack when it comes to the likely Best Lead Actor Oscar winner. It's only because he has been. Oldman should be a heavy betting favorite, and I can tell you that he's been nominated over 40 times for Lead Actor category through the various film critic associations, or that he's won about 25-ish such awards, but instead I'm going to frame the argument by like this. The only competition that have been able to beat Gary Oldman out for a Best Actor award among all critics and major circuit awards in the country.
Right.
Timothy Chalamet has done it 4 times. Daniel Day-Lewis has done it 3 times for The Phantom Thread.
Really?
James Franco, Daniel Kaluuya, Hugh Jackman, Andy Serkis, James McAvoy, and Harry Dean Stanton all hold 1 win over him. That's the list. So you're talking 11 total times this guy's lost and about 40, 45 times.
Right, right, right.
So he is the favorite.
Chalamet is probably considered the next guy.
You would think. And this stats
by a lot
out,
of people.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I think that's interesting. Some awards projections. I guess we still have projections even at this late stage. Feinberg Forecast has The Darkest Hour as a front runner for Best Actor, obviously. Also as a front runner for Best Cinematography, Costume Design, and Original Score. This is kind of weird because it's a major threat for Best Picture, Film Editing, Production Design, and makeup and hairstyling. That's the weird one, because everyone on Gold Derby seems to say that 25 out of 25 experts, that is, best makeup and hairstyling is a shoe-in. 23 of those experts have Darkest Hour getting the win.
Oh, wow.
In that regard.
Hmm.
So that's a little strange.
And Feinberg knows something everyone else doesn't.
Gold Derby. Obviously, 29 out of 29 have Gary Oldman nominated for Best Actor, with 26 out of those 29 having him at number one.
We said Laurie Metcalf was up there, too, with all the wins before she got knocked off her pedestal by Allison Janney. So take it for what it's worth.
It's possible. 13 out of 27 have The Darkest Hour up for Best Cinematography. That's not as strong as I would have thought. Best costume design, 20 out of 25 experts have it up for that. 15 out of 25 for best original score. 15 out of 29 for best picture. Only 2 out of 25 for film editing. And 16 out of 25 for production design. So if all these projections follow through, it's probably going to get 4 or 5 nominations. It'll probably be up in some and not so much in others. We'll see. What were your expectations for this one, Mike?
I mean, it was Gary. Like I said, I've been looking forward to this for about 20 months since I knew it was going to happen. It's Gary Oldman playing Winston Churchill. How could you not be excited about that if you love movies? I was expecting an Oscar-worthy, if not slightly overacted, like you hit on, performance by Oldman, akin to how Daniel Day-Lewis became Lincoln for his awards-winning performance. Otherwise, based on the ratings that I knew going in and the critical reception, I was kind of expecting a fairly nondescript, slightly disappointing film overall based on its acclaim. What about you?
I mean, listen, I'm going to be short for once in my life, and that's why I'm going to ramble on in this prologue to it. No, I expected a better performance and a worse movie. I got a worse performance, and I got a better movie than I thought.
Wow.
That's my expectations. I mean, production values, I guess we can go sight to sound, Michael. I think the cinematography in this movie is beautiful.
I was shocked, and that was one of the first things I told you. I was shocked at how beautifully some of these shots were laid out. I mean, you have 3 vivid scenes, just still shots that like stick with me, at least leaving the theater.
Right.
You have the one at the very beginning when he's addressing Parliament for the first time. You have that kind of spotlight on him.
Right.
Where the darkness is the other government
they
officials.
They didn't know how to light Parliament back then.
Right. They're sitting in the rafters, but it's basically a spotlight on a stage, which was the message that they wanted to lay across. You have when Oldman or what's his name, when Churchill speaks to the country for the first time
what's
over radio.
Face?
Yeah, what's
stupid
that
cigar
guy?
Smoking face.
He has the glow of the red light from the radio shining in his face, and you have that close up of Gary Oldman's face as Winston Churchill,
right,
nervous and kind of paralyzed by his own fear as he takes a minute to compose himself. And at the shot at the very end where he's addressing Parliament for the last time, like you just alluded to, with all the paper flying up in the air.
I love the tracking shots,
yes,
of the citizenry, even though, like we talked about in the prep, it wasn't a film that involved a lot of the public until a certain point.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, but this is a movie about old white men making decisions and talking, and this is a movie about an old man writing a speech at different stages of his writing life, and somehow it's one of the more cinematic experiences that I've had in movies all year, and I don't know if another filmmaker could have gotten it done. Joe Wright is really a master at what he does. I love the camera angles. I mean, it's almost a classical lighting job like we said, in terms of Parliament, it almost has this like black and white hue, right, to it. It's very strange, but I love the master shots. Master shots, just a wide shot, like a full picture. So they get close when he needs to get close, and he needs to give you like that emotion. But he backs up and shows you the whole room, and it's just like a painting on a canvas when he does that. It's probably a photograph of the actual time and place that he draws from, and then he just, totally, cinematizes it somehow. So it's really cool what Joe Wright does.
Yeah, for me, not to inject my personal opinion, but if you go in expecting, at least for me, a good Gary Oldman performance and an okay movie, I think you're going to be most surprised by the cinematography. I mean, it's like you said, it is beautifully shot.
Yeah, the look of this movie is something.
And the tracking shot where he's walking down the hallway. Right. I mean, you just pointed on how the wide shots are very well lit and they make it seem all inclusive. I thought also he was very good at showing the aloneness of Winston Churchill at some time. Like he's walking down this giant hallway underground and it's lit on either side, but it's still darkness behind him, darkness to either side, and it's just Gary Oldman walking down the hallway.
I thought that was beautiful. It's a lot of great
yes, thank you.
But you're right. It's just like a little old man. This is Winston Churchill. Yeah. A little old man with just this gray wall.
Yeah.
Behind him on his bed with his feet dangling off the bed, about to, receive the King of England into his room. And this is a scared bedroom, little old man about to happen. So, I mean, I'm going to get into it when we talk about performances, but you get vulnerable characters in this movie, something that I did not expect at all. I was expected like a Vince Lombardi, just fire and brimstone kind of a guy.
Yeah, no, this is the movie of him becoming Winston Churchill as opposed to him being Winston Churchill the whole time.
Spielberg kind of did that with Lincoln, but even with the Lincoln scenes, it was Lincoln kind of saving the cat. It was Lincoln building up the softer side, like going into his sleeping son's bedroom and lifting the little boy up off the floor with like a piggyback ride. Yes, Lincoln looks a little frail while doing it, but he's doing something good. Here it's just Winston Churchill, like, being debaucherous with drinking and smoking cigars and yelling at secretaries and not knowing what to do and being in doubt about this whole situation and, like you said, becoming Winston Churchill. So they do a nice job visually of making that happen.
Totally.
And Joe Wright is very talented in terms of a visual storyteller.
Kind of blew me away, to be honest.
You look at Anna Karenina, the Pride and Prejudice, the first 30 minutes that I watched, but mostly I'm drawing from Atonement. It's one of my favorite movies of that decade. It's an amazing movie to look at. It's kind of a weird companion piece to Darkest Hour, to Dunkirk, because it's based on the same time period. You do get some moments in Dunkirk, obviously, after the Darkest Hour. Britain is besieged by the Nazi forces, eventually in the Battle of Britain, getting bombed like crazy. Again, Atonement deals with a lot of that. So Joe Wright, his entire career has kind of been circling
around this subject matter.
This subject matter. So I guess we get up to the end of the visuals here. Makeup and hairstyling, for essentially one character, they're going to get nominated most likely and win this award.
His jowls or what, it made it kind of, his accent as far as sound goes in and out. I don't know if we want to start on sound, but his accent kind of went in and out for me. I made the point that there's one scene where Gary Oldman raises his voice and Winston Churchill's getting most mad and he's talking to his people in his cabinet,
right?
And he kind of loses the accent at the top of his anger, and it like immediately you're drawn to, oh, that's the bad guy from Leon.
Yeah. It depends, like, how many scotches he was in.
Right, no, sure.
I don't know. Maybe, honestly, you speak differently if you have too many cigars. I forgot to mention in the production notes, Oldman did get nicotine poisoning at one point during this.
I
think if he's an alcoholic, he's not drinking real scotch, though. But I don't know. I mean, yes, overacting police have taken him into custody several times. But Gary Oldman, in a way, the makeup kind of absorbs his overacting. So I could just like see, I want to like see transparently through his prosthetics. You could see the everyone. The tiger's in it. What is that quote?
You cannot reason with a tiger when your head is in its mouth.
Yes. He's doing the same character for Luc Besson, but he's doing it under all the makeup. Now, I wanted to ask you, Mike, was it distracting, the makeup, at any point? Or just the fact that you knew it was Gary Oldman who was distracting?
Well, the reason I got off course talking about his accent, but the reason I brought up makeup is I had trouble understanding him at certain points, and I don't know if that was due to his prosthetics and his makeup and all the stuff that he had on him, or if it was just that he was talking too fast and I had to like kind of go back in my was brain he, and figure out what he was saying.
Was he like Patton Oswalt says, B-word fat?
I went to the bakery and I went to Britain and bundled up a Maybe. Box of donuts.
Now that I know what that is, possibly.
He was kind of B-word fat. I mean, he's not a fat guy.
No, like, obviously
like
not.
Like me. Yeah. But he was definitely jowled up on
yes, he was.
Certain and, words.
But the overall look, and I said this to you, I thought the makeup was very well done. I saw Winston Churchill.
It didn't distract me either. I was shocked. I was all ready to just like get angry like it was an Oliver Stone 90s movie at the makeup. I was much angry at the post, and we'll talk about that later in the week, the post makeup and hairstyles. But anyway, it was surprisingly very well done, I thought.
Yeah, I'm with you. I was expecting more trouble than I had. I did have a little trouble, but that could be a me problem, as most things in my life are. So I'm willing to let it go. I saw Winston Churchill, and that's what I paid to see.
Moving
I don't have from, much here.
Moving
I'm just
from
be angry.
Sight to sound, I love the score of this movie, too. I thought, like...
I am so jaded about any movie score after these two fucking award shows.
I'm going to do a Spotify playlist and mix Hans Zimmer with this score. It's pretty good. This one hypes you up too.
I didn't even notice it. I went into this movie with
I'm gonna write to this soundtrack. Nobody cares
it was
about
good.
That
it was good
me.
I mean, it was very thematic. It was very
I'm gonna feel
this
cool.
is gonna make me sound like an ass, but like what the dialogue lacked in building the drama, the score tried to make up for at times and making it seem like it was a life and death situation. Which
it
was good.
Was a fucking life and death situation.
We'll talk about it.
Oh my god! I don't know how this is the argument. Because anyway, we're gonna get into it, folks.
Your option is not we should fight or negotiate with Hitler. The option is so very clearly you should fight or die. Even at that moment, they said in the movie Hitler was taking over and going back on his word.
There was, I mean, you look at British history. I'm not even an historian. I read the Wikipedia page. There was a segment of the British Parliament that was going against Winston Churchill
yes.
at the time.
I'm not
trying
saying,
to
I'm
sue
not
for
saying
peace.
It's historically
it was
inaccurate.
Entirely Neville Chamberlain's
yes.
platform.
Which, by the way,
time.
Who I think is the more interesting character deserves his own movie. We'd love to see that.
But you're also right in the fact that Neville Chamberlain kind of takes the movie away at a certain point.
He's the most powerful guy in this movie.
Yeah.
I mean, he controls Churchill. Yeah, but
let's
regardless.
Get into performances. Yeah. I like the score a little more than you. You thought the score made
I'm
up
just
for
so
it.
Disenfranchised
Listen, we
got
to listen to it on Spotify.
I'm just going to put on Dunkirk on my Blu-ray and just sob.
Now, the Gary Oldman performance, is it award worthy in any year?
You tell me. I you know, any year it's tough, especially with your expectations being so high. I walked out of the movie saying weak movie, great performance, and it was going to bring me to ask you a question. What are we giving a best actor to? Do we award these performances in a vacuum? Are we giving these to the performances alone? Is Forrest Gump Forrest Gump, or is Forrest Gump in the movie of Forrest Gump? Is it Gary Oldman as Winston Churchill, or is it Winston Churchill in The Darkest Hour?
Here's the thing. He sold me on being a vulnerable old man, which he is not. He sold me on being a charismatic politician by the end of it. He sold me about being one of these just fire and brimstone leaders of a movement at the very end. He has to get there, like we said. Like
there's
he,
no doubt that you see character development in the Winston Churchill character.
I agree. I never thought this would have become an underdog story, you know? Like, this was not what I was expecting.
No, I don't think
going
many
into
would.
Yeah, like the Lincoln performance, and we keep drawing back to the Spielberg Lincoln
because it's such an easy parallel. I mean, these guys became these historical figures.
Again, you didn't get as many flaws for the Lincoln character, but played by Daniel Day-Lewis, even though kind of the way he argued with his wife and the way he, you know, pined over his child's safety after the death. It was all understandable, though. Like, this was a truly heroic person through and through. And I guess you...
He was honest Abe.
Honest Abe, right? Through
As
and through.
To,
even
yeah.
though... But you get, like, Churchill flat out talking about, okay, sacrifice those 4,000 people.
Like they're nothing.
Yeah.
Like, and to put that in the context, there's a decision to be made in
like
the cabinet.
Like throwing a Hail Mary, too.
He wants to basically give up 4,000 young men fighting for the country of England to draw gunfire away from the people at Dunkirk to try to get his soldiers out of Dunkirk
and Lincoln,
and sacrifice these
Lincoln
4,000
guys. Lincoln got there, right? It got there, basically, all right, he's weighing whether or not to keep the war going to get the 13th Amendment passed or not. That was a definite dilemma at the end of Lincoln, so it got there. But this is the very beginning of the movie where Winston Churchill is faced with this dilemma of Dunkirk, yeah. Right? Dunkirk, all the English troops are basically cornered into what we talked about in the Dunkirk episode. Basically, Nazis have them with all their tanks. And I wonder, revisionist history-wise, I got to do a deeper dive on this, but I wonder if they were, in fact, trying to work the back channels, because they would have known, Hitler would have known at the time, Hitler might have known at the time that they might have been better suited to let Britain surrender, and rather than have to bomb the crap out of them, rather than have to overtank and conquer them, because these back channel negotiations were in fact going on through Italy.
I mean, Hitler has proven, and we talked about it in our Dunkirk review, and if you were a historian of any type, Hitler wasn't a great tactician.
But it would make
sense. Charismatic leader, but didn't make the greatest battle decisions.
But here's my point, and here's my pondering, I guess I would say, because I don't know. I'm not a historian, like I said. But if they were doing these backroom deals, or these back channel deals, just like kind of how we did with
leaks.
Russia.
Yeah, the apartment.
We did them with Russia leaks. Before the Cuban Missile Crisis, mm-hmm. right? And if they had these deals going on behind the scenes, back channels, it would make sense that Hitler might pause the tanks there.
Not blow the shit out of the English.
Yeah, we can't know now what that side was going on. But if in fact, and based on the dates, May 19th, like we talked about that fateful day, that's when the back channels start to go through in this movie, which jives with the Dunkirk research that I did going back May 19th when the movie started.
Yeah, maybe.
When they, you know, that anniversary of the fateful pause, yeah. That's the same day, I think, I'm pretty sure, that Churchill actually considers. Gave the conflicting advice to Halifax.
Maybe he'll go through with negotiating.
Maybe they'll go. So that's when they started talking to the Italians, El Duce.
The easy flip side of that argument is, would Churchill know that? You know, would he send out a feeler knowing that maybe Halifax
would
has
stall
some connections?
Them?
Yeah, who knows?
Listen, you and I have talked ad nauseum about every sign that we read in between the lines about sports trade talks and sports, you know, dealings behind the table.
You're going to say you didn't see anything?
I mean, LeBron's doing his press conference in Greenwich. he's got to be going to the Knicks, right? I mean, Kyrie's saying what to the Cavs? And, you know,
no, there's
only
one way to get to the bottom of this. Let's dig up Adolf Hitler, please.
Yeah. I guess we'll get more into the plot and spoilers. To move from the main performance, which we both agree is just captivating in a way.
Yeah.
Vulnerable, like we said. Intense, like we said.
Yeah, but let's argue. Let's talk about the other performances in this.
The supporting cast is incredible actors.
Yes.
We'll agree on that
yes.
much. I like the Ben Mendelsohn King George.
I have no problem with the King George. I thought he showed the second most character arc.
I thought he had some intensity. I thought there was a lot of consideration in his face in the sense that he's considering what to think of Churchill.
I didn't like that he just kind of sided with Churchill without an inciting incident other than standing out on his porch and saying he was angry.
That's kind of the whole thing. The king turns, well, we'll talk about it in spoilers. Yeah, I'm with you. I definitely have devil. I'm going to play devil's advocate with myself in spoilers. Wait till you see this. Anyway.
He's been angling to have this podcast to himself for a while.
Lily James, we both agreed, was very, very, very
loved
good.
Both women, female leads in this. Loved them.
Kristen Scott Thomas was incredible in this. She's getting nominated.
Their characters are treated like dog shit.
I don't understand the arc of the Kristen Scott Thomas character. It's
either
very,
of them. I don't. The secretary
not enough.
Does nothing to. I mean, she's at. Well, I won't talk about what she does in the last scene, but like, she didn't even provide him any sort of emotional support that he leaned on. She tried to, but he never actually gave her enough credence to be an important figure in the eyes of the audience.
I think I have a take on it. I don't know if I'm right. Again, I've got to push you to spoilers. Best worst scenes, we're probably pushing there as well. Any final thoughts on the movie? We had a lot of thoughts.
I mean,
right,
my
up
best
front.
Scene is the scene in the preview. I thought the Oscar reel scenes are his best scenes.
Right. He's got a lot of moments in this movie.
You can't do
big
it. You can't negotiate
ones.
With a tiger when your head is in his mouth. I thought that was, you know, all those big speeches I was a sucker for. I can see him winning because of those.
I'll have a little information for you in spoilers based on the real history, but I won't have as much as I've had in previous pods. But
hey, you want to dance? We can dance.
We can dance.
You want to dance?
We can dance if we want to.
You leave your friends behind because their friends don't. I may just keep singing over the techno music. Spoilers ahead. Spoilers ahead!
This is a spoiler. Warning.
Spoilers. 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 Spoilers.
Mike, and Oscar Sprint, spoilers!
Alright, this is the spoiler section for Darkest Hour. The Nazis lost the war.
They wound up losing.
Yeah, that's the spoiler section. Alright, listen to us next week. No, we're going to talk about the twists and turns and the outcome of the Darkest Hour. If you're looking for the non-spoiler stuff, the production profile, the specs of the movie, box office numbers, all of that is in the spoiler-free section, the first hour or so I think we did this time.
We joshed.
We lost ourselves.
We had fun having a conversation.
But now we're going to talk about the spoilers, so if you don't want to hear the spoilers, or if you haven't seen the movie yet, or you don't want to hear this part, don't listen to it. But if you have, you want to know what happens, even if you haven't seen the movie and you're curious to hear about the ending, stick with us. Let's talk about best and worst scenes. Just as a recap, I said at the end of the non-spoiler section, my best scene is the Oscar reel scenes. You can see him in the preview, the one where Gary Oldman gets so fired up, but he doesn't lose his accent and lose himself in a different character.
That scene builds nicely, though, too. That's like an argument interrupting.
I'm a sucker for political arguments, and I think that one was well done. You could say the whole movie is a political argument, but I have issues with it.
Explodes and he walks out.
Yeah.
And he's like finally becoming Winston Churchill in a way.
Right. And you could see him winning the Oscar on the back of that, at least to me. What was your best scene?
The drop the mic moment after his big speech is one of my favorite moments of the year. I loved the way they shot that, looking up at him, walking out the doors in the final shot of the movie. I love the papers falling down.
So this is after Churchill gives his We Will Never Surrender speech to Parliament. And
yes.
Neville Chamberlain has decided that his party too will back Churchill in this time of need, and everybody goes crazy.
So that was a great moment. The Lily James cheering him on, cutaways to Kristen Scott Thomas wearing the military uniform, which is the climax to her character. The best worst scene for a lot of critics
and me
is the scene in the subway.
So stupid.
Now, I'm one of the people who, after watching this, I was like, okay, I kind of like the scene, but I hated the fact that this seems like total bullshit.
Exactly. It's a fairy tale.
And it bothered me. However, I had to gulp like Christopher Nolan at the Golden Globes wanting to cry when that little girl screams no. When she goes no and everybody pauses because he's basically asking everybody on the train if they want to fight.
Again, Churchill is in a car. He gets out of the car, goes missing as he was known to do apparently, and goes down to the subways of London to hobnob with the people on basically the advice of King George. And ask them their thoughts about what happened. Should we negotiate a peace with Hitler? And all the English people say, no, absolutely not. We'll fight them. We'll fight in the streets. We'll fight to the death, blah, blah, blah.
I think one of my favorite online YouTube, you know, like miniature movie review websites is What the Flick. And they got the TCM guy. They got a bunch of really good critics there. And they seem to say, you have subway people and you have the non-subway people. Which one are you? I guess I'm a reluctant subway person because I like the way that scene played out. The critics break down into people who like that scene and who don't like the scene.
Right, right. I get it. It's cute.
Do you like the scene or not like the scene?
It's a terrible scene. There's no precedent for it. Like, you don't see the outside of those walls outside of, like, flashes of war. It's not an action movie, but...
But the movie builds up to that. The fact that this guy is isolated in his own little world of politics, in his own little world of luxury, and is arguing with other white men, but here he sees all these citizens in long, beautiful tracking shots, right?
Yeah, one.
Through his car. No, there's multiple times that happens. He is dealing with photographers at times. He makes jokes with his butlers about pooping.
Yes.
But you don't see it. And yes, he makes friends with his secretary, who's a primary character in this movie after getting off to a rocky start with the Lily James character. So you're wondering why this vulnerable old man who's making mistakes and who's lying to the country is such a big deal, and why how he's going to become such a big deal. You needed that catalyst. Now, I researched this in a bunch of different articles, fact-checking articles online. There's three or four. apparently Churchill, they have no evidence that he did this, such a thing at this time. However, Steve Pond on the Rap, John Broich on the Slate, a third article on the Telegraph. They all mentioned that liberties were taken in the movie, but that McCartan mostly researched it well. The subway scene was not something that probably most likely happened at this particular juncture.
However,
he did it a lot after they got in really in the mix in the fight with the British. He did it a lot. He would go, they would call
then
it,
show it
Churchill
then.
Goes AWOL. Dramatic license, artistic license. This was what endeared him to the people so much
you
later
either
on.
You need to. I'm so sick of these scenes getting by and using their story narratives with throwaway scenes that aren't alluded to ever. They're not built up in the like. Yes, the crowd.
It's
the
built
people,
up and foreshadowed.
The people.
You have to say
the
that.
People of London were talked about and
the,
hit on.
The king literally tells
yes,
them to go do it.
Yes. Yes. But they're not a part of this movie at any point. Until they need to be to give Churchill his confidence, which is a cop-out to me.
But
just
that's the whole problem with that he's wrestling with. He finally goes to the people. Then he finally goes. He doesn't go to his war council first after he speaks to the people.
What,
he goes to his outer cabinet, which is essentially
everybody else.
What role did
the people play outside of that scene?
Well, they played the most important role in convincing him. And there was a lot of polls
at
the time.
Outside of that scene in the movie, what role did any of the people...
scenery. Yo, you're right.
Yeah,
I agree.
It's so stupid. It's like having a tree come to life and talk just to get a point over.
I don't think it's that much like a tree.
Well,
here's the thing. The Lily James character is a very much a servant of his, right? The butlers he jokes with, like I said, I'm doing a few slight gymnastics to like it, but it also bothered me a little bit. I'm not going to lie. So my devil's advocacy, and this is the biggest problem I have with the movie to get into my worst scene, is expositional dialogue. Now, in the post, I'm going to really have problems because expositional dialogue is mostly what that script structured
is,
as.
And
it's
what
not,
are the Pentagon
it's
Papers?
It's not Battle of the Sexes bad, but it's rough, and this movie does a lot of that. Now, I don't know British history like I know Watergate and, you know, Washington Post history that I'd studied back in the day as a student and that I did a deep dive without looking at the light of day for weeks while I read All the President's Men and watched it. But anyway...
Oh my God, I found out who shot JFK.
It was me. No, I didn't know a lot of this stuff about Viscount Halifax and Neville Chamberlain. I didn't know any of that stuff. So when they do the expositional dialogue, I'm like checking boxes off in my head. Oh, I didn't know that. That's helpful information to me. That's my worst scene, is the expositional dialogue throughout the movie, that the more you rewatch it, the more it, you know, reveals itself. But like I said,
I thought it was awkward of the film to kind of hold your hand and explain, like, not hold your hand at all when it came to explaining the especially in this day and age, after what just happened over the summer, not explain how much of a threat the Nazis are. And even though the internet and stuff wasn't around back then, people knew. I mean, news knew what Hitler was doing to these lands that he conquered and these deals that he made. I mean, they knew he wasn't a man of his word. They knew he was out for Eastern globalization, basically.
But yet you had a whole party that was trying to sue for peace and work the diplomatic channels.
Right.
So I don't have a problem with that. You have America, and basically, for me, as a World War II, my knowledge of World War II and my Americanism here, thrusting my chest out, Britain knew they were going against 5 million Nazi troops. They're 300,000 with their standing army. So why the hell would they want to just go and attack this guy?
Without the
Americans signing peace treaties and neutrality agreements,
right.
FDR that they mentioned in this movie, Stalin doing his thing, not helping Poland, and waiting basically for the Nazis to attack him before he gets involved.
But you're saying there was too much exposition. You're not told.
We don't get the full context.
Yeah, and
we also don't get
an antagonist in this movie outside of...
Well, the antagonist is Halifax.
It's not. He's a surrogate. He's basically a surrogate of Hitler. Hitler's the bad guy.
Who's the one who is defeated at the end of the movie.
Yes, I understand that.
It's Halifax.
But there are no stakes.
The stakes are whether they sue for peace. What do you mean no stakes? How do you say things like 100% certainty? No, it's fucking black. It's fucking white. How do you say
there
that?
There are no stakes.
You can't draft a running back in a fucking
because
top five.
You and I know how dangerous Hitler is. People at the time knew how dangerous Hitler was. That wasn't built up at all.
They have the opening shots of the newsreel footage of the Nazi army. They seem to show you the play-by-play on the maps while they're right. getting their ass kicked by the Blitzkrieg.
Yep.
It's more of one of those monsters in the background that never shows its face because we all know how bad Hitler is. We all know how horrible he is. We all know
exactly.
that Winston Churchill, finally the guy to stand up to him and stand up to him first and actually fight back, and prevailed a little bit, especially in Northern Africa, to convince the Allies to get involved. I mean, if these people didn't make the stand in terms of World War II history, we wouldn't have the world order like it is today, like Gary Oldman said. So I just think the fact that they don't negotiate negotiating with Germany is unrealistic. Because they're outnumbered by freaking 4,700,000.
I'm not saying it's unrealistic. I'm saying it's such a difficult point to argue because I know how ignorant it makes me sound because you're taking it from the point that I'm saying like, well, Hitler was always this monster and everyone always knew it. And I understand that wasn't the case. But
there's a lot of information that comes out afterwards. But you're also right in the sense that
in making the calls in Britain for their army did know he was a dangerous man. If you know he's that
dangerous, fighting him before Churchill gets in.
They're not going to think about negotiating a peace with him if they just saw what he did to the Eastern European nations that he made.
He also has 300,000 of their troops cornered. And like I said, I don't think it's a coincidence.
And that's why
he
doesn't have an antagonist either.
But I don't think it's a coincidence that he pauses on the same day in the movie that he starts back channel talks. I mean, that I think the filmmakers are telling you that is pretty curious because he for no reason pauses his tanks before advancing on Dunkirk, allowing them to dig in and delay it further like we did on our deep dive there. So that's fascinating to me. I don't know if that's true, but I would like to learn more about it. I think the big bad behind the whole thing, almost like the first of a fantasy trilogy, like the Dark Lord and behind it, is Hitler. But in terms, I would argue that the antagonist of this movie going against the hero of this movie is Lord Halifax trying to argue diplomacy.
What?
Because, and Lord Halifax is the one who raises the white flag at the end.
I get it, but there's no,
with the JFK
there's no stakes. There's no danger presented in this movie. There is no danger. Like, I understand being a student of history.
Annihilation.
I get it.
What are you talking about?
I get
about?
It,
no
but
stakes.
That's not pointed out at all. There's no, like, there's no, my
out.
God, we can't fall to Hitler because we're all
they
be fucking
show
turned.
The 4,000 troops get bombed with this beautiful aerial shot. They show
yes,
the soldier
they did this.
With his, half his face burnt off on the ground. They have the maps of all the red dots
yes, and all
surrounding
this came,
the tiny two
all this
dot,
came
blue
after
dots.
Winston Churchill, the fearless leader that we all need to pull for, just said, fuck those 4,000 guys.
I
we
think,
can get rid of them.
I think.
Like, there's no
I think
stakes.
You're right. I think you're right in the sense that he doesn't hold your hand, Joe Wright, the filmmaker, and
it's
show
not,
you
I don't even
20 minutes
yeah,
about how bad Hitler
exactly.
is.
Just
we all know.
Some,
but we all
but,
know.
But you're relying on us to know. Like, you're relying on. If we all know that, then why is it so outlandish to think that they could have known at the time, too?
They,
that thinking negotiating
Winston
wasn't,
knows.
Wasn't an option.
Winston knows. And
agree,
Winston barely doesn't consider it until it looks like all is lost.
I agree.
So that worked for me, but the problem is you're not going Churchill versus Hitler in this movie. You're going Churchill versus Halifax. You're right.
But
the stakes
Churchill
of that,
wants it, but Churchill frames it as if it's Churchill versus Hitler the entire
really
movie.
Really, Churchill versus Chamberlain and the man he has to convince. And this is like one of those weird screenwriter tricks.
You're not wrong. You're not wrong.
Because the man he has to convince is Chamberlain, and the fact is,
but he makes
he does convince him.
Right, but yeah. Churchill makes it personal against Hitler, calling him names, calling him all these different kind of animals, the savage. He never really addresses Halifax being in the way.
He doesn't realize Halifax is such a formidable enemy. He puts him in his war council, right? It's such a team of rivals. Go back to more Lincoln speak. It's such a team of rivals that Halifax is in his war council.
Yes.
you have the man who is your biggest thorn, who wants diplomacy. He doesn't know all the back dealings are happening, just like a hero in a movie or in a story doesn't know necessarily all the moves of the villain, especially the big move at the end that he really, after his biggest blowout at Halifax, the tiger in its mouth speech, Halifax walks out, talks to him, and says, "I am going to resign," which essentially means you are going to be ousted as prime minister if you don't take diplomatic
speeches.
You're
not saying anything wrong. I can't put... I'm having
trouble
putting...
Quite the dilemma is what I'm saying.
I'm having trouble putting into words. There was just something lacking for me in terms of the bad guy and the stakes. And I know that is absurd to say when you're dealing with Hitler and the Nazis in World War II.
But I'm trying to tell you, I think you're right in the sense that this movie is
I win the argument. I win. No, I'm the greatest. I'm the champion. I win.
It's a movie.
I have my hand
It's
raised.
A movie about Winston Churchill versus Halifax with Hitler looming is what I'm saying. So
I don't disagree in the fact that that's a whole other movie. I don't know if we cut it, but Halifax is basically the Hitler surrogate, quote unquote, because he wants to do what the Nazis want them to do.
I think Halifax doesn't represent the fascism that I've researched since then. The fascism of the English aristocracy that was prevalent at the time. I think a lot of the English didn't want to side with the communists because they thought they would lose their wealth at some point during this process. Again, they're outnumbered by almost 4.5 million, if not more, German troops. And they don't have the war machine, even with, you know, Australia and India coming into play. I mean, they're not as outnumbered as I think, because India is going to send millions,
I'm not disagreeing with anything
troops,
you said.
So
it's making me think that I need to rewatch it, because I there was just something missing for me, and I wish I could be more articulate about what it was.
Well, what I'm guessing is that it wasn't between Hitler and Churchill. This was not that movie. This was between Hitler and Halifax.
I get that, and I don't want to leave the impression that I thought, you know, Hitler should have been shown more, because I understand that wasn't the point of the movie. I understand the point of this movie was the back dealings, the behind the scenes of why England did what they did in terms of dealing with the Nazis in World War II before America got involved.
The antagonist surrenders with this final quote. He mobilized the English language and sent it into battle. Yeah. That was actually a quote by JFK about Winston Churchill, said by Stannis Halifax Delaney. At the end of that movie. So that was interesting to me. They use a lot of true
famous quotes
and give them to other characters throughout this movie. I didn't do all the research on that, but I noticed that throughout my research, and I think that you guys should look at that. What do you think about this as a companion to Dunkirk?
That's one of the questions I wanted to ask you. Do you think this movie is helped or hurt by Dunkirk coming out in the same year?
I think it is hurt a little bit. I'll be honest.
I don't think there's any question.
I think you're right. I think as historical deep dives go for history buffs and nerds like me, I kind of like that this is happening at the same time. I like that Five came back. Doing a lot of World War II stuff this year, which is surprising. I like that circular kind of thing. I want to watch Downfall now, the Hitler German film.
I own it, actually. I'm too busy watching Legion.
Mike has a crap rack. If you haven't listened to one of our old retrospectives, you should. We dish on Mike's crap rack. Now, listen, he never seen these movies because they're still in their plastic.
The Spirit,
Legion, and
The Double.
Oh, there's some bad movies in there. So the only reason I'm still sitting here across from him is that he hasn't actually watched those movies, but I'm a snob.
Yes, no, I enjoy World War II as well. I the whole era, and that's why I hate that I am not in love with this movie, because political dramas I love, World War II subject matter I love, and you combine the two to make this film, and it's short for me.
I wonder if the expositional dialogue was what turned you off. I don't know. That almost turned me off. But here's the thing: like expositional dialogue, when it gives you context, like I said, historical context in particular about something you don't know about, that's helpful, and yet it's a problem because it's not dramatized, it's non-cinematic. However, there's also another kind of expositional dialogue that's interesting to me, is like Dark Knight, right, by Christopher Nolan. They speak in this elevated, you know, speech.
Yeah, nobody
habits,
speaks
right?
like they do.
Nobody speaks like that. It's not real talk. I mean, it is essentially refreshing to us at the time of that movie release, because we're not watching a Saturday morning cartoon, which is what we're used to in every superhero movie we ever saw. Now we got this hard-boiled detective crime drama, even though they're speaking in this elevated philosophical language.
God,
these diatribes.
Miss Heath Ledger.
Yeah, I mean, we got a little sick of it going into The Dark Knight Rises, I think, and then I was shocked to not see it in the movie Dunkirk, of all places where you could have it, plenty of it. So this was like, to me, the story behind Dunkirk, obviously it is. And this was, to me, all, like, as a companion piece, it works together so well.
Yes, it does.
With
it does,
Dunkirk.
It does work well, but in, and maybe this is part of it, I don't know, and I've been racking my brain for the last 2 days trying to figure out what it is, but Dunkirk, you're given the score, which I, you know, obviously I'm biased towards it, but I think it's so beautiful. You're given that lack of dialogue just to see the setting and that feeling of claustrophobia for 90 minutes, and it's so short and compact, and it fits so much into into 90 minutes, an hour and a half. And the not even the expositional dialogue, but just the dialogue and the word-centric feel of this movie without that edge-of-your-seat drama, which there should be because the Nazis are fucking here, you know, trying to take over the eastern part of the world.
Yeah.
I think Dunkirk, in terms of understanding Darkest Hour, I think it absolutely helped. Like you said, companion piece, 100%. In terms of entertainment of the movie, I think it hurts. Fairly big time, I'll say.
Yeah, because people are not going to go see too much World War II stuff in the same year. I don't know. I loved it. I loved the double dip into the storyline. I loved the double dip in terms of the
I got to rewatch Darkest Hour now. I'm upset with myself. Well, don't listen to this podcast. Turn us off immediately.
I'm thinking back to more of the stuff. I guess we could hit on the major plot lines for a second. I think Churchill did a nice job, like with the picture with the peace sign. Or up your bum,
yeah,
but its hands are flipped around.
That humanized them for sure.
Yeah, I think that was a nice little ad there. I thought the mumbling when he's thinking about Hitler and he can't get the words out, he's trying to come up with a speech.
Can we hit on?
It's like a wrestling. The whole plot line is like a wrestling with the speech and how to talk to the public is what I'm talking about in this movie. I think that just dawned on me as an epiphany. Like, he's trying to figure out how to communicate with his people. And I think the scene in the underground, in the subway, was him finally connecting to his people, finally
coming
out.
You know what would have helped, too? How about a scene where he's addressing the nation and we see some people absorbing and digesting what he's telling them? As opposed, you know, like, maybe that's why the subway scene pissed me off so much, too, because we don't know that these people are happy beforehand, that they're all buying it beforehand.
In the movie, it happens through surrogates. It happens through Lily James.
Yeah.
In the movie, he wins over the king, who's his first subject, or his first citizen that he's responsible for. He wins over, you know, his wife and his kids. He wins over his
butlers. These are all people with their foot in the fire.
Right.
You know, like, they're not...
And it's
they're not the people that give him his big groundswell of support.
It's his main flaw that he does not go to the people in this story. He does not deal with the people in this story. That he isolates himself. That he does everything behind closed doors. That he's not transparent. And in many ways, you know, Joe Wright is doing and he's structuring the story, and so is McCartan, about functional government and government that totally, you know, steps in it. You know, and I think all the stories of his failures from his past, Gallipoli, you know, the story of how he got stuck as this party member who was so disliked by so many factions of the political sphere in Britain back then, to where he's like this compromised candidate that has to be voted in. So the fact that it gets to that level, and then and he has to slowly but surely start to get the will of the public, not just behind him, but in his head, what it is.
Let me ask you a question, because it's maybe it's a lack of understanding on my part, which I find hard to believe since I'm the smartest man alive.
You're a smart man.
Did you enjoy this more? You enjoy this movie. You're on record as saying this is a watch
for you. Three
times. This is a watch for you.
This is a watch for me.
And I'm going to say it's a pass for me. Did you enjoy this more as a student of history or as a film student?
I enjoyed it as a film student. I enjoyed it more as a student of history. So that's a weird way to answer that, but that's my honest answer.
And that's what I would think you would say, because you obviously know more of the ins and outs of history and having done the research on that end for the production profile than I do. And maybe that helps you form a better picture of it. And I guess that's kind of part of my reasoning too, in that, in what you said, Joe Wright doesn't really hold your hand at any point in terms of providing the backup historical information to create a clear picture of what's going on here.
He does so poorly at times is my biggest beef on the movie. However, I agree with you. He doesn't, he doesn't handle the exposition well in a lot of scenes, and they're ham-handed a little bit at times, but the visuals are awesome.
Without question.
I really enjoyed, and I've come to appreciate, the arc of this story. How true it is fascinates me. And I'm trying to do research on seeing what's true and what's not.
Yeah, I'm hoping it gains points for me on rewatch, and I do plan on watching all these again, obviously, as we're getting towards the announcements and the Oscar noms on January 23rd. We got to kind of finish up here. Do you want to talk about the role of the women? Expand on that a little bit.
We knew going in this was going to be a movie about white men making deals and white men talking. I think you're right in the sense that the women, the arcs of the women didn't work that well.
Is there a B or C storyline in this movie?
The Lily James B story arc kind of brings you in. I don't know if it's if that's the B story. I think, well, the B story is a structural piece of a screenplay that essentially collides with the A story at the midpoint of the movie, the central climax of the movie. That's how it's supposed to work. So the central event of this film, the B story comes in. Like in Star Wars, the B story involves Han Solo, and Han Solo is the one who kind of rescues Luke Skywalker in the Death Star, right?
So what's the
they join together. My guess at this point, and this is without really analyzing the screenplay, just with a couple watches, is that the Lily James character and her arc is the B story that comes into the central climax, or it's the central event of doubt, which revolves around whether or not he should, you know, negotiate with Italy. In the middle of this movie, before Operation Dynamo and Dunkirk happens, Lily James, after the loss of those 4,000 men, they show it with the big cinematic shot, the bombs dropping on their heads. Or before that, because Churchill's writing the note to them, right? She's having her transcribed.
And he's showing her on the map where they positioned.
That's what happens. And essentially, Lily James is, her agency is to ask this man who's so in his own head to lead her to more of a knowledge of the situation. She becomes the first citizen that he
sways,
becomes a leader with, right?
And had they made that point more clear, I think I would have less of a problem with the subway scene. If you're supposed to know that she is the everyday person, because again, to me, she's too close to the action herself, even though she's quote unquote just his secretary.
If we clearly get her POV though, POV for through a lot of the movie, like when we meet Churchill, it's her POV.
Oh yeah. 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 I'm not arguing that.
When
I'm just
she's
saying,
going through the underground bunker, right?
But also government. citizens don't have access to the places she was taken. You know what I mean? Like the everyday people of London.
She's an insider, but when she's typing the Churchill note in the letter that we don't have your evacuation plan coming, she just like freezes. And then he asks her about her brother who's died in the conflict at that point. So she, in a way, he gets to know her personally. And when that happens, she tells him what's bothering her, why she's frozen, not just about her brother, but the fact that nobody tells him anything. Like everything's been secretive. And
right.
Churchill
realizes
in that moment that this is the problem
he has to face. Yes.
He has to be truthful to the people. And he starts with this one person. So
that's fine.
If that's the B story, then that makes sense.
Now, that said, I think the role of the women, I think, was handled very poorly for having two such strong feministic characters. I don't think there's any progression in their story. I mean, Kristen Scott Thomas is in had his birthday party holding back tears, saying she's accepted the silver medal to his public life. And she's okay with that, and that's kind of how she's kind of learned, and that's the most dramatic you get. You don't see that as a chip on her shoulder. You don't see it as a means of motivation. It's nothing.
I think what Joe Wright sold her on was Winston Churchill is screwing things up the first half of this movie, and she is the voice that is trying to be supportive of him, right? She starts very happily doing it in the beginning of the movie. Well, we want you to be more likable now that you're prime minister, right? Mm-hmm. And by the middle of the movie, she's like, we are broke and you cannot spend this money anymore. And then later in the movie, she's like giving him the pep talk, like, and it's desperation where she disagrees with what he's doing about leading the country through all this misinformation. And she's like, listen, you are strong because you have doubts, because you've been through the shit. That's why you're strong. And, you know, the climax of her arc really didn't have it for me. And I would agree with you. Like, if she's the mentor character that is with this light hand and this light touch and this deft touch, right, trying to sway him towards being truthful and being the man he's supposed to be.
I mean, to me, and on first impression, you, as soon as you meet her, you think that she's going to be the character that stands for behind every good man is a great woman, you know? Like, you think she's going to be kind of the puppet master in a sense, and really, he ignores her for the most part.
I think where this movie is smart with the performances, he recognizes that she doesn't buy his bullshit in those scenes. Like when he comes home and he's got the heavy feet, they make it a big point to show his heavy, slow gait walking out of the first speech he does, walking towards her, like through the back ways into their sitting room.
Yeah.
And she gives him this like half-hearted speech about, oh, you were wonderful tonight, honey. And he knows, and she knows, it was both bullshit, right? So that made sense to me. Like, she doesn't have to tell him and tear him a new one to get him to change his tacts and his political tact in this war speech. But she is like the one who brings him the king. And I think that's probably her most important scene, because she She sets him up to actually listen to the king's plea.
Yeah, stop feeling sorry for yourself. You got work to do. Right.
That's her biggest moment, I think. And that
makes
sense.
But it wasn't given enough credence. She is
the most useful ally, and I would, in many ways, a mentor in the film. The king is also a mentor character.
I guess I'm just mad. The potential for both those women could have been.
Actually, I think the king is the rival. In terms of hero's journey speech, he's the rival that he wins over, right? By the middle of the movie, when during the dinner table scene, right, the king realizes that Churchill has all this self-loathing and doubt about being unwanted and thinking himself unqualified for the role.
I love this scene.
While he's feeding the dogs.
Yep.
So the king is like, all right, this guy's feeding my dogs. He's here speaking to me. He's much like I am. So one of his best friends is
and
Halifax.
The king was flipping out, whereas Churchill was like,
right,
bullshitting.
One of his best friends is Halifax. And that's why the scene where he's looking out over his kingdom in London.
God damn it. Did you change my fucking opinion of this movie? This is either going to be our most listened to episode ever, and you're going to be just take over forever, or I'm going to have to step up the one-liners a lot going forward.
I've seen this movie a lot,
no,
Michael.
I think you're making a lot of good points, as you normally do in terms of coming from the writing world and the screenplay world that you do.
Well,
and
when you said, do I admire this movie as a film student, I do very much
right.
so.
And you make that,
for those
you
reasons.
Make that clear, and you point it out well, but I don't know. I mean, listen, you may be right. I may be crazy, and it may just be a lunatic we're looking for. I know I murdered that line, but still. Well, now that they're irrelevant, let's go into final grades, since I'm going to have to rewatch this movie and start from scratch after your Freudian-like intellect.
I had it, after my first watch, at an 87 B plus, 87.
You had it that low, and you were able to see that much in it?
And then I kind of bumped it up to an 88.
Right.
I forgot better. That I changed it to an 88,
right,
which is like even with the Florida Project. So, I mean, the thing is, like, it is not on the tier of a Lady Bird or a Get Out for me. It is not on the tier, even close, with Dunkirk,
well,
Lady Bird, Get Out.
Movies for a wider audience.
It's below Call Me By Your Name. It's below like that of the Three Billboards tier for me.
Right.
So it's kind of on the tier of, like I said, the Florida Project, both movies that mean something to me that I can admire. But I wouldn't hate if it's a Best Picture nom, but I wouldn't. It's one of those movies, like, I don't want to see this Best Picture. I don't want to see Shape of Water Best Picture.
Oh,
I'm like in that moment. Like, this is on the tier above Shape of Water,
well,
below.
I think part of that is this movie could have come out any year and had as much cultural and relevant impact as it did in this year.
Right.
Whereas Lady Bird, Get Out, Three Billboards, maybe even, couldn't. they're special for being out when they are. But nonetheless,
yeah, this could have come out any year. Yeah,
my grade, I got something right for my grade. My grade, not that it matters because I have to reevaluate both this movie and my life and where I've gone wrong.
No.
I had an as an 85. I was fairly. I don't like calling a movie boring. It wasn't connecting for me on some level.
And I don't think you're wrong for that to be the case. Yeah, but I mean, I think you're – it's almost like I asked myself the question, like, why do I hate The Post, which I'm coming out with next week?
Right.
Am I
– you're already taking it over. This podcast is now yours, which I'm coming out with next week. I'm coming out with The Post, and I'm kicking off the co-host.
No, but I hated The Post. I've seen it the last two nights. I've hated it, and – I'm wondering why I hated it, because a lot of the same things that I hate in The Post are in The Darkest Hour.
Right.
So I don't think you're wrong necessarily, but I think I might be just as wrong as you about The Post.
We're going to have, as we get closer to Oscar time, we're pretty sure we're going to have our own special award show for ourselves where we're going to be giving out what our nominations are, would be, should be. We're going to be able to reevaluate at that time, so look forward to that coming up as the Oscars draw closer. And I have a feeling I'll have a different grade, or maybe I'll just refuse to watch this out of spite for you and for everyone else. We'll see.
To each his own.
Let us know what you thought. Have you seen The Darkest Hour? Did you like it? Do you agree with also, Mike? Do you think it was lacking something? Can you help me point out what I was missing and couldn't articulate earlier in this podcast? Hit us up. Let us know. Mike, and Oscar on Facebook. Mike, and Oscar on Instagram. MMO_pod on Twitter. We are Mike, and Oscar @gmail.com. Hit us up about Darkest Hour, any of the Oscar Sprint profiles. Did you watch the Critics' Choice Awards? Do you have a gripe with Shape of Water winning Best Picture and Best Director like we did in our Critics' Choice recap? Did you watch the Golden Globes? Do you think the Time's Up blowback is going to have an effect? Did the Oscar voting end too short? Let us know.
A lot of intriguing questions.
Any thoughts you have on the entertainment industry in Hollywood going forward? We'd love hearing from you guys. Hit us up on those. And if you haven't seen Darkest Hour yet, watch it and figure out which one of us is way off base.
Could be me. I'm not going to lie.
I don't think it is.
I did my best. I mean, I like it. We don't talk to each other going into the movies, and we try to, like, formulate our opinions. And me nowadays, because, like, Michael just ambushed me as a lawyer, and I, like, freaked out, and you scare me. You
talk more about
intimidate
that.
Me. No, I'm arguing with a lawyer, so
do
I
still
like
scare
really
you?
Research this stuff. I got to see The Post again because now I'm afraid Mike's going to love it and I hate it.
I'm going to see The Post 18 fucking times. I'm going to embarrass you on the next episode. Until next time, guys. Reality sucks. Keep watching movies with us. Honestly, reach out to us. We love hearing from you.
We're having a blast doing this thing.
And we'll see you next time. Later.